Hi, I'm Bruce Valanche, and you are listening to the Fandom Squad Podcast.
You are now entering the Fandom Squad Podcast. Enjoy the madness.
Hey everyone, this is going to be another episode of the Fandom Squad Podcast. My guest this week is the amazing Hollywood legend, Bruce Valanche. How's it going?
What can I say? Legends. Legends are us. He's a legend. Homer's a legend.
Yes.
Bacon's a legend. Maybe a legacy. Not even. That. I don't know. Anyway.
So how are you? Just to get started, so how did you get into the industry? I know you started as a stand-up. How did you get into the writer side of things?
Well, actually, I was a child actor.
Oh.
But, yes, but I was never a child star, or we'd be having this conversation in rehab.
Yes.
They don't do well. But I was a child actor, and I always, I grew out of I grew out of my parts. It sounds porn, doesn't it? I grew out of my parts. I had a deep voice, and I was heavy, and I was auditioning. Grew up in New Jersey and New York, and I was auditioning opposite actors who were like authentically the age that I was trying to play, which I wasn't. And so I started writing. I found I had a knack for it. My parents encouraged it because they were afraid, you can't make any money in the theater. And they said, newspapers will never die. What did they know? So I went to college and I got a degree in journalism and theater. And I went to work for the Chicago Tribune and started writing about what I knew, which was show business, because I'd been in it since I was a kid. And I met Bette Midler in Chicago. She was just starting out, and began writing for her. And I began collecting people I was writing for. And so, and then every night I would go at 11. There was a club in Chicago called Punchinello's, which was kind of like an after theater sort of club. Like, they would float in around 11 o'clock. And I would get up at midnight and do the news of the day, like Weekend Update, basically. With my own spin on it. And so that was as far as I got into stand-up, because I after 5 years of writing for the paper, I came out here to LA to write a television show, and I stayed. And then I was basically, I was acting and writing, but more writing. And occasionally I gave myself an act. What happened, there were so many friends were dying, and they were they're dying of AIDS, and it was they were gay, and a lot of people back then were out to their friends, and but they were closeted to the family back home in Indiana. So when they died, the family would swoop down and they would discover all these things about them, and they would take the body back and bury it and have a funeral, but all the people who were really important in this person's life were left holding a bag. So we had a memorial of our own. We called them celebrations, and I started emceeing those. And as a result, people said, oh, "You should, do a stand-up, because you're funny. You keep these things afloat." And I thought, "My God, AIDS kickstarted my stand-up career. How will that? What are the optics of that?" But I eventually let go of it, and I said, "Okay, I'm going to give myself an act," and so I started doing it. But I was never like a club comic, I wasn't in. I mean, I wrote for a lot of club comics and I hung around, but I never really, I felt that I was, too different. I mean, I didn't have that energy that club comics have. And I told stories basically about stuff I had done, and it was a whole different thing. So I never really had, I call it sit down, not stand up. But, and that it all kind of happened at the same time. And then after 20 years of that, they came to me with Hollywood Squares and said, "Would you be the head writer and make it?" And we wanted to be funnier, more funny than game show. And I said yes. And Whoopi said, "Well, he should be the center square. He should host the show." She was a center square, and I'd written with her for years. And so they tested me, and it was like, "And this is for the win, Louise." And, well, you're not exactly what we are looking for in the host. This was before RuPaul's Drag Race.
Yes.
They said, you know, you're a little left of center. So they put me left of center. They put me next to Whoopi, to the left of Whoopi, if that's possible. And I, for about 6 years, I was there. And when you're on television every night, you become famous. And, you know, people ask you to write a book and all sorts of things happen. I did Hairspray on Broadway. I shaved my beard and I was a mother for 2 years. I toured the country. And so it goes. You know, it's been 20 years since that. So that basically the fable
awesome,
of my
awesome.
Legend. And, yes. And you know, and I mean, I wrote a lot, you know, 25 Oscar shows. And I'm the EGOT of award show writers. Emmys, Grammys, Oscars, Tonys, I've written them all.
Right? Oh, yeah. So to them, you were a little too eccentric than what they were looking for.
at the time, yes. They thought... Well, you know, they wanted it to be funny, but they wanted it to resonate as a real live game show that was not a joke. And so we had Tom Bergeron, who, you know, was brilliant.
Oh,
and
yes.
He launched a whole career in that, but he was, you know, we were lucky to get him. He's a great guy, but he was terrific in the role, and the show was a great success, you know, until they destroyed it. It was great.
Yes. So how did you go from that or before that? How did you get involved with Paul Lynn?
Paul, well, one of the many shows I was writing Donnie and Marie. That was one of the shows. Donnie and Marie, the Osmonds, before you were born, I'm guessing.
Yes.
Had a variety show on Friday nights, and I was one of the writers. And Paul, who it was, of course, a Hollywood Center Square of fame, was a regular on the Donnie and Marie show. I was actually, they were paying him off for a sitcom that didn't work. And I was writing a lot of his material on Donnie and Marie, which was not as edgy as his Hollywood Square stuff, because it was a real family show. And but it was, you know, it was Paul. I mean, there was no way you could get around, you know, Paul being edgy. And we would finish Donnie and Marie, and he would say, "Come with me to Squares. I haven't got shit." And we would ride over the hill to NBC and write jokes. And so I was writing for him then. And then at that same time, part of his deal at ABC was he got a bunch of specials. And one of them was the legendary Paul Lynde Halloween special, because the idea, Paul Lynde was on Bewitched playing Uncle Arthur. He was a member of the coven. So the idea of Paul of being a witch at Halloween was not that remote an idea, because
yes.
People had seen him on Bewitched for a couple of years. So we made him a big old witch on Bewitched, and his sister was the Wicked Witch of the West from The Wizard of Oz, and she showed up, Margaret Hamilton, the original Wicked Witch. And
oh, witchy, amazing.
Witchy Poo from H.R. Puffin Stuff, which was a Saturday morning kid show.
Oh, I love H.R. Puffin Stuff with Marty those guys.
So Witchy Poo and the Wicked Witch were his sisters, and that was their coven. And they were gathering for Halloween. And they had all kinds of strange people there, including Kiss, of all people.
Oh, my gosh.
Making their first network television appearance, which was very, very odd.
I think my dad told me about it. He's one of the original Kiss Army members. I just found
at
my grandma's. I found his little pamphlet where it's like, for $5, you get the belt buckle, the album, and you get, I think, another a pin or something. And I was like, $5. He's like, "Son, $5 in 1972 was like, that was a lot of money."
Well, the fan club, and I guess they were called the Kiss Army, they were there. And the shocking thing to us was that the guy who ran the fan club, who was quite young, was Ringo Starr's son.
Oh, awesome.
And the idea that Ringo was old enough to have a grown son, and that we, of course, were old enough to be older than the grown son, alarmed a lot of people. This was like 1977, 78, something like that. So it was weird. And of course, it was perfect that Ringo's kid was the head of the Kiss fan club.
Yes. Now, I know there's a lot out there. If you can tell one, do you have any Paul Lynde horror stories or any moments of being with him that just made you go, "Oh my God, that was a hilarious moment"?
A lot. because he would, you know, he would get, he was brilliant on one drink, but on two drinks, he became the Nazi high command, and he hated everybody. He hated, "It's the Jews, it's the blacks, it's the Puerto Ricans. I mean, he was just, yeah, Mexican. I mean, he just was awful. He would go off on people. And then there was a famous story, which actually is true. Well, the Osmonds, and for the last year of the show, last couple of years, I think, they moved it. They built a studio in Utah, where they were from, because they were devout Mormons. And the studio was in Provo. It was actually in the town called Orem, which is next to Provo. And we used to say Orem is what you cannot do in Provo. So we would fly up there every week and do the show. And the writers would fly up on Monday and do the table read and then fly back. But occasionally, one of us had to stay to fix things. And Paul was up there for the week because he was rehearsing numbers and sketches and all that. And of course, if I was up there, he would come pounding on my door at 9 o'clock. Let's go out. Let's get laid. And we would go to, we'd go out. And he closed every gay bar in Salt Lake City, both of them at the time. And they had to send the Osmond police, the Osmo Fuzz, to come and bail him out. And he was always in trouble. And the joke of it was, and then it was, you know, very, very Mormon. Salt Lake City now has a big gay population. There's a whole district called Marmalade, which is bizarre. It's named after a fruit product that is the gay neighborhood. So, but there's a famous story about him flying on Western Airlines, which was the based in Denver and L.A., and they flew the nonstop to Salt Lake. And he would get very drunk on the plane. And there was a crying baby on the plane. And he got fed up and he staggered down the aisle to the lady, and she had the baby, was crying. And she looked up and she looked at him, she recognized him, you know, and gave him a big smile. And he walked over and said, "Lady, either you shut that baby up or I fuck it."
Oh my God.
Yeah. And it was like, you know, she was looking at like this Uncle Arthur from Bewitched. And so he was, when the plane landed, he was informed that he was no longer welcome on Western Airlines, which was subsequently bought by Delta, which is why Delta flies into Salt Lake City. It's a big hub.
Oh, my gosh.
But I don't know if Delta honored Western's commitment. And it may be one of the things that brought Western down. Who knows? But you know, Paul enjoyed a beverage, and he was not good on. You know, you had to catch him before you know, while Dr. Jekyll was still in the building, before Mr. Hyde showed up.
Yes, yes. I think I've heard that story on Gilbert Godfrey's podcast before, because I think he asked somebody about it.
I think Alec Mappa tells it. In his show, and somebody else tells it. I mean, it's gotten around, but I was there when that actually happened. I mean, I am there to verify the fact.
That is amazing.
I was not on the plane, but I was in the orbit when it happened.
Oh my gosh!
And a lot of people, it's become one of those things that, you know, a story that people repeat.
Yes. So for you, what is the difference between writing for like a sitcom versus writing for an award show? What is the difference in the dynamics for something like that?
Well, a sitcom, you're writing for a show that's already settled. I mean, it's fictional. There are characters, even if the character is based on the performer, like Roseanne or Seinfeld or Tim Allen shows or Ray Romano show. You're still writing for a character that is there, and all the other actors, they're all characters, and there's a situation, and you're writing to that. When you're writing an award show, most of the people who are coming out there don't do an evening at Carnegie Hall. You know, there are people, the stand-ups are people like Billy Crystal and Whoopi, and they have a stage persona that they use when they are on stage. Or they have characters who they play, and they incorporate that. But a lot of actors, like, you know, when Johnny Depp comes out, or Keanu Reeves, or Michelle Pfeiffer, they don't have a character to play. They've never come up with one. They haven't had to. Yes. I mean, they're genuine actors, and that's what they do. So you have to come up with something for them to do, to project some kind of personality. And generally the way you do it is you deal with the task at hand. So if they're presenting an award for art direction, you find something they can say about art direction that makes sense, maybe referencing some of their work, you know. And but it's difficult because they're not used to this. You know, they are used to being handed a script and a character, and they can, you know, figure out what to play. That's why so many times when you see them on talk shows, you know, they're like kind of lost. I mean, what they do on talk shows is there's a segment producer calls them earlier in the week to find out what they can talk about that they'll be comfortable with, and to try to like pull stories out of them. So when Jimmy Kimmel says, but I understand you were on a plane the other day and Paul Lynde came up, you know, whatever this story is going to be, but it's, they know they've been cued in to tell this thing that they've already rehearsed with the producer. And most of the time when those people are on shows, they're there to promote a specific project. So they come armed with things that they have been given about the project. I mean, I watched Tom Hiddleston last night, was on Jimmy Kimmel, and he was plugging this new series he has called the Essex Serpent. But all Jimmy wanted to talk about was Loki. And every time he mentioned Loki, there were tears and screams and carrying on. So, of course, he has a trove of Loki stories because he already did the circuit when Loki came on.
Yes.
Just, you know, could repeat the Loki stories. And Jimmy had to actually kind of force him to talk about this movie that he was doing. It's an Apple series, I think, The Essex Serpent, and which was funny. I mean, you know, that, it was an interesting example of how it works because, you know, Tom Hiddleston is not headlining in Vegas, you know?
Yes.
He's an actor. And of course, all they really want to say is, what's it like fucking Taylor Swift? That's what everybody really wants to ask. Fortunately, it's just impolite.
Yes.
If you want to know what it's like, she's probably written a song about it, so you could probably find it there. You just have to figure out who she's talking about.
Yes.
Because, you know, no ex-lovers remains untouched in her vocabulary.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
She goes after them all, yeah.
Now, I definitely have to ask, because I know a lot of my listeners here are more on the big geeky side of things, so you have to definitely tell me the story of how the Star Wars special came about and how inebriated all of you guys were while writing it.
Well, you know, I've told the story many times, and as a result, I see things online saying Valance, who admits to copious drug abuse, and, but I don't admit to any such thing. I embroider. I mean, it was the 70s, and as I've said many times, if you remember the 70s, you weren't there. Because we were all kind of like half-baked. We were all half-assed, but we were also half-baked. And a lot of the things, it was not that consequential. And I say that because a lot of people who are Star Wars fanatics are very mad about that show. And when I tell them that, well, Star Wars was not that big a deal at the time. It was a big hit summer movie. But there hadn't been those kind of franchise pictures, and it kind of started that. And it was only the one movie that was out. This was a year and change later. And he was about to start shooting The Empire Strikes Back. So he didn't have a canon yet. But what happened was he did this as a kind of promotional tool to keep the Star Wars idea on the bubble, to keep it stirring. And he had six movies. He told me he had 10 stories he'd written, and six of them were going to be movies. And he eventually made six. And the other four he sold off into different things. And this one idea he sold to CBS as a special to kind of promote the thing. And it was a musical. And it was about the Wookiees. And the funny thing was, I think that George, two things. I don't think George knew much about variety television. I think he really thought he was giving them an original musical and that it was going to be like a musical, like Rodgers and Hammerstein's Cinderella, like that kind of a musical. And, however, if he really did think that, I don't know why he sold them the story that featured the Wookiees, who are characters who cannot sing and cannot dance and can barely move in those outfits and who don't speak in any known language. They sound like fat people having orgasms. Trust me, I know. So it was crazy. And a lot of people said, well, this is another one of these ridiculous specials that they'll load up with stars. And so we went to work trying to take this story and his characters and bring in the required elements from CBS, the stars and the production numbers, et cetera, et cetera. And of course, everything that we did in that regard bastardized what they were doing. But of course, the whole show looked way cheap compared to what the movies were like. The movies were, you know, were beautifully done. So it came and went, you know, and people thought it was a joke, and they thought it was over Thanksgiving holiday sort of, and they said, well, this is kind of fun, this is really stupid. It was no better or worse than a lot of other crap that was being, churned out by the very same people. What happened was he made the first three movies, and then the internet came in. Well, first of all, a generation grew up watching those three movies on VHS and Betamax and the original format of VCR. And then the internet came in. And by that time, Star Wars had become the Scientology of the nerds.
Yes.
You know, it was a religion. And this, they discovered this special on the internet. And they were staggered and betrayed. And they said, George, how could you do this? And he got scared because they were coming after him. And he tried to get bury every copy and burn and all. Of course, they survived. But he freaked out and disowned it and all that kind of stuff. And then the heat went off of it because he then started making Star Wars movies again. But every time he does a Star Wars movie, it comes back. It comes back to the point that, I mean, I don't know, he's done, what, 5, 6, 7 movies later, and it keeps showing up. And finally he had, when Disney, who acquired his company and now owns Star Wars, when Disney said, let's do a Star Wars holiday special with Lego, he said, okay, fine. And they even referenced the old show. And the Lego thing, I don't know if you saw it, but it was hilarious because they had the Daisy Ridley Lego looked like Rosie O'Donnell. It was very weird.
Oh, yes.
But they do reference the show, and they reference Life Day, which is the holiday that George came up with in the original special. That was what the Wookiees were doing. The Wookiees were, they had to get, Chewbacca had to get home to his home planet for Life Day. So he and Han Solo and Leia are in the Millennium Falcon racing across the galaxy. To get back in time for the Wookiee holiday, for Life Day. And they do, and Carrie got to sing some simpering Life Day song at the end of the thing. I mean, I looked at it recently because I'm writing a book about all of this.
Oh, and, awesome. Yeah, I'll definitely, once you get that, I'll put the links in the show notes.
It's called, It Seemed Like a Bad Idea at the Time.
Good title.
And there's the opening chapter is all about Star Wars, and but in detail, in forensic detail, I pick apart the entire show, and my contributions to it. You know, I was not alone. I had collaborators, I had partners, and George was with us at the beginning, and he booked early. He saw the hieroglyphics on the wall, and he ran back to Marin. But he was there. He was called a few times, and but he wanted to get it. He didn't want to get any of it on him.
Oh yeah, I've always told somebody because I'm like, I know some of the new films get hate, and I'm like, if you're a true Star Wars fan or part of this Star Wars religion, like, you have to watch the holiday special. It is a rite of passage.
Yeah,
so I told my girlfriend, I was like, you're getting me into horror movies. I'm getting you into sci-fi. I was like, I know you know the Star Wars franchise. I'm gonna show you. You're going to have to sit with me through this entire hour of a special. I was like, it's going to hurt, but trust me, you're going to know true pain afterwards. Now, I have to ask as well, with people like, you know, Harvey Korman and B. Arthur, did either of those, which are known as comedy legends, did either of them have any input to the characters that they portrayed in the special, or was it sort of already written for them?
It was written, but they're both geniuses. Harvey was, he loved, he had to play several different characters. He did Julia Child as an alien. With
yes.
First we take a leak. Let's make a leak soup. So he had the script, and then he embroidered as he went along. He improvised. There's one moment that's absolutely brilliant, really good. I mean, it rises above the whole show, where he is a robot, and the robot's breaking down, and he alternates between being a functioning robot and like a kind of a, you know, like a I had to say like a robot with Alzheimer's. I mean, a robot. Because it's just because there's a loose screw or something, but he physically goes from being these two different individuals, and of course it's just him.
And I thought that was an editing. Is that where he's doing the little manual thing?
No, he's doing all that stuff. He's really
That is amazing. I always thought it was an editing thing that it was just kind of chopped. That is amazing.
No, he was amazing. Now B was Maude at the time, which was a big TV show. This is way before Golden Girls.
Yes,
but she had come from Broadway. And she wanted to sing. Nobody ever let her sing. So she said she'd do it if she could sing. And she had this Kurt Weill, Bertolt Brecht song that she wanted to do, the Alabama song. You may know it. Frank Zappa
yes.
And the Mothers of Invention did it on an album called Weasels Ripped My Flesh.
Oh, love Frank Zappa. Love Zappa.
It's Zappa. And it's Zappa. He's shaving with a weasel who's like pulling.
Yes. Point.
Don't it? He was heavily, I'm sure he was as influenced as we all were at the time.
Oh, yeah, there's the famous toilet picture of him with the top hat and everything.
So it's a great song, but the Bertolt Brecht estate didn't think that Bertolt Brecht wrote the song so that she could sing it to a bunch of aliens in the cantina. So Ken and Mitzi Welch, who were staff writers on the Carol Burnett show and wrote a lot of special material for Carol, parodies of Hollywood movies and things like that. They're very musical. They wrote a song which kind of aped this Alabama song, and which was all kind of like, those were the days, my friend, we thought that kind of a song.
Yes.
And B got to sing it, and that was the whole reason she did the thing, so she could sing. And it was very dramatic the way she did it. It was hilarious because she was surrounded by all these aliens.
Yes.
I mean, they were kind of looking at her through all their 17 eyes. And, so strange.
Oh, yes. Now, so how did you get involved with the Brady Bunch and the Brady Bunch special? Because I know, did you work on the series or was it just the special that they brought you in for?
It was another series, actually. There was the Brady Bunch series was done. And there were many, many variations on it. There were the Brady Kids cartoon show, and I mean the first actual spinoff was the Brady Bunch Variety Hour, and that came from Fred Silverman, who was running ABC and who had put Donnie and Marie on the air. He picked them out of the Osmond family, and they didn't want Marie to work. They wanted Marie to be a good Mormon housewife, but she was talented, so Fred said they should be a team, and so they became a team, and they had a variety show. Fred believed in teams. And so he thought the Partridge Family, which was also defunct, but in the Partridge Family were actually a family, a show business family that toured in a bus, if you know anything about
it. Oh, yes.
Or remember the Partridge Family. And Shirley Jones was the mother, and David Cassidy and Susan Day were the hot kids. And so the idea was the Partridge Family would do a show about being the Partridge Family and having a television show, and they passed. So he said, well, the Brady Bunch, which was the other half hour in that hour of the Brady Bunch and the Partridge Family on Friday nights on ABC. So he went to the Brady Bunch, and the Brady Kids had an act that they used to take. They used to play state fairs and things. And so they were all singing and dancing, and it didn't take much to get Florence and Bob Reed back in the fold, because Florence was a Broadway musical star and she wanted to stay in LA and raise, she had four kids she wanted to raise. And Bob Reed kind of who hated the fact that he was now a sitcom dad. He was a serious actor, but he leaned into his comedy side and thought, okay, I'll try it. And he, of course, could not sing or dance, and that was one of the standing jokes of the show. But it was a limited series because Fred bought three shows and showed them on what was called a wheel. So every third week we would be on. And the other two shows were The Hardy Boys and Nancy Drew, the two mysteries, but Hardy Boys I don't think has been rebooted. Hardy Boys was a hit. Nancy Drew got rebooted on the CW many, many years later. But every third week, the Brady Bunch was on. So we only did nine of them. We did the pilot and eight others. Because that by the time we aired all of those, the season was over, you know, and we were into summer reruns. So it was a limited series, is what you could say, because it didn't get picked up because the numbers were terrible. And we were opposite 60 Minutes, for Christ's sake.
Yes.
I mean, we were opposite 60 Minutes and The Wonderful World of Disney.
Ooh, that's a good, I love that.
Which at the time, you know, just before Disney bought ABC, they were on NBC. And so we were opposite those two shows, which were both powerhouses in their field, and we were not.
Yes.
And truly, anybody who would watch the Brady Bunch Variety Hour was probably watching Disney.
Oh, yes. I love the documentaries like that. Especially there's the episode where they show like how he made the animatronics using the people's actual movements. I love that episode. Seeing that 60s technology mixed with what would become futuristic technology, right, which is amazing.
Sure. Yeah.
So for anybody out there, what is some advice that you can give that if somebody wants to become a writer or, you know, be pretty much do what you do as like a comedian or just a writer?
Well, if you want to be in comedy, I think the first rule is be funny. A lot of people are not funny and they think they're funny, but you really do have to be funny. And the second thing to do is you have to be ready to give it away, because at the beginning, you're going to have to give it away. And you're going to have to be willing to make a lot of other kinds of sacrifices, unless you have a very large penis, in which case people will flock to you. Or huge, you know, huge bazooms. They'll flock to you. I mean, that's the first rule of Hollywood. Me Too has not been able to stop that.
Yes.
I mean, it stops the way people take advantage of it, but it doesn't make it go away because it's the oldest profession. So,
oh, yes. Just ask Dolly Parton.
Yeah. Hello. I'm working with her now. So hello. Exactly.
Yes.
Right. But yeah, what I would say to performers particularly, I don't know about writers so much, but performers, I mean, the internet is a gift. I mean, YouTube is a gift. TikTok is a gift. I mean, look at the people who have no talent, who have made millions of dollars by being influencers.
Oh, yes.
You know? I mean, so if you actually are talented and you use that as a platform to showcase yourself, I mean, they'll go crazy for you. And that never existed. I mean, you used to have to pound the pavement, you know, to get seen by people. And now, I mean, there are people just trolling the internet looking for the next big thing. So if you're a performer, get out there and do it and put it on tape and, I mean, you know, give it away. As a writer, it's still a harder thing, but you can create written material, which you can then sell as a basis of something else. I mean, many people have written just that they'll have a website and they will write something and then they can sell it to a magazine, to a newspaper, to a syndicate, and it winds up becoming the basis of a novel, a movie, a TV show. There are lots of incidents of that. So I think it's a lot easier now than it used to be. There are a lot more people, the internet, there are a lot more people who are encouraged who should not be.
Yes.
Because, you know, they can, I created a webisode. I did a web series, you know, it's like, oh, honey. They are so sad. They're not going to get you. I mean, you know, if you're talented, it might get you something. But if all you have is ambition and money, it'll get you to a certain plateau, but it's not going to get you beyond that.
Yes. Thank you so much for coming on. All right, everyone. That's going to be another episode of the Phantom Squad podcast. Would you like to say our outro? We also enjoy the madness.
Enjoy the madness.
Here's a little bonus for you. Bruce couldn't fully remember the joke during the interview, so he allowed me to play this clip of it from YouTube.
A sadist, a masochist, a pyromaniac, a zoophiliac, a serial killer, and a necrophiliac are having tea. It could happen. And the sadist says, let's find a cat and torture it. And the pyromaniac says, let's find a cat, torture it, set fire to it. And the zoophiliac says, let's find a cat, torture it, set fire to it, and fuck it. And the serial killer says, let's find a cat, torture it, set fire to it, fuck it, and kill it. And the necrophiliac says, let's find a cat, torture it, set fire to it, fuck it, kill it, and fuck it again. And the masochist says, meow.
All right, everyone, I hope you enjoyed that little bit of dark humor from Bruce. I know I like a little dark humor in my life. And remember, enjoy the madness, everyone. You are now leaving the Phantom Squad podcast. This podcast is produced by Phantom Punk Productions and is a proud member of the Discussing Network.